Thank you very much, Petrock. Well, Sweden rules at tonight's BBC Prom with a Swedish orchestra, soloist and composer, but there's some cross-border Scandinavian entente cordiale through our Danish conductor. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where the Swedish Chamber Orchestra will be performing under its chief conductor, Thomas Dausgaard. Their concert begins and ends with more bicentenary celebrations for Robert Schumann, the final work on the programme being his most Beethovenian symphony, the second, a musical account of his journey through depression. Before the symphony, we've the UK premiere of a piece by a composer who cites James McMillan and Thomas Ades among his musical heroes, which sounds promising. And Albert Schnauzer also has Haydn as a source of inspiration. It should all come together in his intriguingly titled A Freak in Burbank, whose subject is a Haydn-esque film director. The first half ends with a groundbreaking orchestral song cycle, Berlioz's setting of poems about lost love and loneliness, his Les Nuits d'été, Summer Nights, in which the soloist is the Swedish soprano Nina Stemmer. And, as I said, the Swedish Chamber Orchestra begins with Schumann as well. The young composer had already decided that someone had to continue on the path forged by Beethoven's symphonies when he damaged his right hand, to the extent he had to abandon any ideas of becoming a concert pianist, and the writing of symphonies became his main concern. The opening movement of his never-to-be-completed Symphony in G Minor was his first orchestral work. He admitted he'd no teacher to help him at the time, and so had worked almost entirely according to my own ideas, and am moreover somewhat distrustful of my symphonic talent. Thomas Dausgaard.
Here was a young Schumann, I think 22 years old, and not over-familiar with the orchestra and the possibilities, but perhaps that's interesting too, because he wasn't in any way inhibited by knowing too much about how to write it. So there's some unusual touches, but what is most striking for me, I think, is the way the music disintegrates. And this is pointing forward to so many other of his works throughout his life, the way you suddenly see down into the darkness. And this is right here in this piece.
Well, the leader of the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, Katarina Andreasen, is already on the platform. She's just tuned the orchestra, and here comes Thomas Dausgaard to conduct the first movement of Schumann's incomplete symphony in G minor, the Zwickau. Schumann's first go at composing something symphonic. The first movement of his incomplete symphony in G minor, Zwickau, performed to open their BBC prom by the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. Schumann may have revised that music a couple of times, but what we've just heard in the Royal Albert Hall were his first thoughts, the orchestra using parts prepared from Schumann's original manuscript score. Well, the second symphony, which the Swedish Chamber Orchestra plays at the end of the prom, is the most Beethovenian of Schumann's completed symphony. Young Schumann was a real Beethoven devotee and appalled by how few composers had taken up the challenge of becoming his symphonic successor. The only worthy exception, he felt, was the young Frenchman Berlioz, and it's his music the Swedish Chamber Orchestra plays next with Thomas Dausgaard when they're joined by the soprano Nina Stemme for a performance of his song cycle Les Nuits d'été. Berlioz counted several poets among his friends, one of whom was Théophile Gautier, a fellow romantic whose world vision was close to his own, as was his home in Paris. Berlioz was very taken with Gautier's collection called La Comédie de la Mort and set six of the poems, the result a miraculous response to the poet's images of melancholy love, originally written for voice and piano, but when you hear them, you can't imagine Berlioz didn't know he would eventually orchestrate them. Gautier's summing up of his friend's music applies particularly well to this song cycle. He represents the romantic musical idea, the breaking up of old moulds, a complex richness of orchestration, unexpected effects in sound, amorous or melancholy dreaminess, longings and questionings of the soul which escape language but may be divined in music. The opening villanelle is a spring song, a celebration of happy lovers in the countryside. The Spectre de la Rose takes us into the warmth of summer. I am the rose you wore yesterday at the ball. My tomb is your breast, and my epitaph here lies a rose, the envy of kings. The third song, Le Lament sur les Lagunes, strikes an intense note of despair and total loss as the lover sets out bereft on his sea voyage. Absence is the core of the cycle, evoking great longing over unimaginable distance separating the lovers. In Au Cimetière, in a churchyard, the poet is offered no relief from his despair among the ghostly shadows of tombs and yew trees. And finally, the sixth song, L'île inconnue, we emerge into a sunnier world. And if we can't find the land where love lasts forever on our voyage, then at least we're on an exotic journey of the kind Berlioz longed for. So now, here comes Nina Stemme, followed by Thomas Dausgaard, joining the Swedish Chamber Orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall to perform Berlioz's song cycle, Les Nuits d'été, Summer Night.
Oh.
Take me, says the fair one, to the shore of fidelity where love lasts forever. That shore, my dearest, is hardly known in the land of love. Where would you like to go? The breeze is about to blow. The final verse of L'Île Inconnue, the last song in Berlioz's song cycle, Les Nuits d'été, Summer Nights, which has just been performed here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, by the soprano Nina Stemme, with the Swedish Chamber Orchestra conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. Utterly romantic, but looking to the future. The first orchestral song cycle on its own until Mahler's Songs of a Travelling Wayfarer a quarter of a century later. Back comes Nina Stemme with Thomas Dausgaard. A splash of colour, you might say, Nina Stemme. Crimson with a black sash, and then the dress itself, a sort of black currant, luminous, vibrant. Just right for that wonderful orchestration, which Nina Stemme says she loves. And originally written for low mezzo-soprano and tenor, she negotiates those songs gloriously. Wonderful Isolde, of course, at the Royal Opera House recently, for which she won an Olivier Award. At the moment, busy in Lucerne, singing Leonora in Beethoven's Fidelio, semi-staged, conducted by a gentleman called Claudio Abbado. She sung these songs, Nina Stemme, with piano, but she says she now feels sorry for pianists, trying to somehow make something that sounds vaguely like this fantastic orchestration, particularly in the churchyard song. Just amazing. Nina Stemme back on the platform, taking the applause of audience and performers alike. She's worked with Swedish Chamber Orchestra for a good 15 years, really since it was founded. Thomas Dausgaard has worked with her for that length of time. Well, after the interval, we hear the UK premiere of a piece by the Swedish composer Albert Schnelzer, who, according to his biography in the programme, grew up experiencing a potent mixture of Tim Burton, Pink Floyd, the poet Edith Södergran, and Beethoven. A Freak in Burbank is a response to the film director Tim Burton's childhood, in which, says Schnelzer, he takes the spirit of Haydn to an American suburb to see if it'll survive. And then to end this evening's BBC Prom, it's back to where we began with Schumann and his Second Symphony, a masterpiece that's not often been given its due and for which the Swedish Chamber Orchestra and Thomas Dausgaard are the most persuasive of advocates. But first, 20 minutes, and it's perhaps rather apt that before Albert Schnelzer visits LA, a character should find herself emotionally and geographically caught between Europe and America in the classic short story by John Cheever, A Woman Without a Country.
I saw her that spring between the third and fourth races at the Ciampino with the Conte di Capra, the one with the mustache. Drinking Campari at that nice, easy-going track, with the mountains in the distance and beyond the mountains, a mass of cumulus clouds that at home would have meant a tree-splitting thunderstorm by supper. But that amounts to nothing over there. I next saw her at the Tenerhof in Kitzbühel, where a Frenchman was singing American cowboy songs to an audience that included the Queen of the Netherlands, but I never saw her in the mountains. And I don't think she skied, but just went there like so many others, for the crowds and the excitement. Then I saw her at the Lido, and again in Venice late one morning, when I was taking a gondola to the station, and she was sitting on the terrace of the Greti, drinking coffee. I saw her at the Passion Play in Errol, not at the Passion Play, actually, but at the inn in the village where you have lunch during the intermission. And I saw her at the horse show in the Piazza di Siena, and that autumn in Treviso, boarding the plane for London. Bluey. But it all might have happened. She was one of those tireless wanderers who go to bed night after night to dream of bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches. Although she came from a small lumber mill town in the north where they manufactured wooden spoons, the kind of lonely place where international society is spawned, This had nothing to do with her wanderings. Her father was the mill agent, and the mill was owned by the Tonkin family. They owned a great deal. They owned whole counties, and their divorce proceedings were followed by the tabloids. And young Marchand Tonkin, learning the business, spent a month there and fell in love with Anne. She was a plain girl with a sweet and modest disposition, qualities that she never lost, and they were married at the end of the year. Though immensely rich, the Tonkins were poor-mouthed, and the young couple lived modestly in a small town near New York where Marchand worked in the family office. They had one child and lived a contented and uneventful life, until one humid morning in the seventh year of their marriage. Marchand had a meeting in New York, and he had to catch an early train. He planned to have breakfast in the city. It was about 7 when he kissed Anne goodbye. She had not dressed and was lying in bed when she heard him grinding the starter on the car that he used to take to the station. When she heard the front door open and he called up the stairs, the car wouldn't start, and could she drive him to the station in the Buick? There was no time to dress, so she drew a jacket over her shoulders and drove him to the station. What was visible of her was properly clad, but below the jacket, her nightgown was transparent. Marchand kissed her goodbye and urged her to get some clothes on, and she drove away from the station. But at the junction of Alewives Lane and Hill Street, she ran out of gas. She was stopped in front of the Beardens, and they would give her some gasoline, she knew, or at least lend her a coat. She blew the horn and blew it until she remembered that the Beardens were in Nassau. All she could do then was wait in the car, virtually naked, until some friendly housewife came by and offered her help. First, Mary Pym drove by, and although Anne waved to her, she did not seem to notice. Then Julia Weed raced by, rushing Frances to the train, but she was going too fast to notice anything. Then Jack Burden, the village rake, who, without being signaled to or appealed to in any way, seemed drawn magnetically to the car. He stopped and asked if he could help. She got into his car. What else could she do? Thinking of Lady Godiva and St. Dap. The worst of it was that she didn't seem able to wake up. To accomplish the transition between the shades of sleep and the lights of day. And it was a lightless day, close and oppressive, like the climate of a harrowing dream. Their driveway was sheltered from the road by some shrubbery, and when she got out of the car and thanked Jack Burden, he followed her up the steps and took advantage of her in the hallway, where they were discovered by Marchand when he came back to get his briefcase. Marchand left the house then, and Anne never saw him again. He died of a heart attack in a New York hotel 10 days later. Her parents-in-law sued for the custody of the only child, and during the trial Anne made the mistake, in her innocence, of blaming her malfeasance on the humidity. The tabloids picked this up. "It wasn't me, it was the humidity," and it swept the country. There was a popular song, Humid Isabella. It seemed that everywhere she went, she heard them singing. Oh, humid Isabella, never kissed a fella unless there was moisture in the air. But when the skies were cloudy, she got very rowdy. In the middle of the trial, she surrendered her claims, put on smoked glasses, and sailed incognito for Genoa. Of course, she had a boodle. Her sufferings were only spiritual, but she had been burned, and her memories were bitter. From what she knew of life, she was entitled to forgiveness, but she had received none, and her own country, remembered across the Atlantic, seemed to have passed on her a judgment that was unrealistic and savage. She had been made a scapegoat, and because she was genuinely pure-hearted, she was deeply incensed. She based her expatriation not on cultural but on moral grounds. By impersonating a European, she meant to express her disapproval of what had gone on at home. She drifted all over Europe, but she finally bought a villa in Tavola Calda and spent at least half the year there. She not only learned Italian, she learned all the grunting noises and hand signals that accompany the language. In the dentist's chair, she would say, "Ai!" instead of "Ouch!" And she would wave a hornet away from her wine glass with great finesse. Her villa was charming. Nightingales sang in the oak trees, fountains played in the garden, and she stood on the highest terrace, her hair dyed the shade of bronze that was fashionable in Rome that year, calling down to her guests,
"Bentornati! Quanto piacere!"
But the image was never quite right. It seemed like a reproduction, with the slight imperfections that you find in an enlargement, the loss of quality. The sense was that she was not so much here in Italy as that she was no longer there in America. She spent much of her time in the company of people who, like herself, claimed to be the victims of an astringent and a repressive moral climate. Their hearts were on the shipping lanes, running away from home. She paid for her mobility with some loneliness. The party of friends she was planning to meet in Wiesbaden moved on without leaving an address. She looked for them in Heidelberg and Munich, but she never found them. Wedding invitations and weather reports, snow blankets, the northeast U.S., made her terribly homesick. She continued to polish her impersonation of a European, and while her accomplishments were admirable, she remained sensitive to criticism and detested being taken for a tourist. One day, at the end of the season in Venice, she took a train south, reaching Rome late on a hot September afternoon. Most of the people of Rome were asleep, and the only sign of life was the tourist buses, grinding tirelessly through the streets like some basic piece of engineering like the drains or the light conduits. She gave her luggage check to a porter and described her bags to him in fluent Italian. But he seemed to see through her, and he mumbled something about the Americans. Oh, there were so many. This irritated her. "I am not an American."
"Scusi, signora," he said. "What then is your country?"
"I am a Greek." The enormity, the tragedy of her lie staggered her. "What have I done?" she asked herself wildly. Her passport was as green as grass, and she traveled under the protectorate of the Great Seal of the United States. Why had she lied about such an important part of her identity? She took a cab to a hotel on the Via Veneto, sent her bags upstairs, and went into the bar for a drink. There was a single American at the bar, a white-haired man wearing a hearing aid. He was alone. He seemed lonely. And finally he turned to the table where she sat and asked most courteously if she was American.
"Yes."
"How come you speak the language?"
"I live here."
"Stebbins," he said. "Charlie Stebbins, Philadelphia." "How do you do?" she said.
"Oh, where in Philadelphia?"
"Well, I was born in Philadelphia, but I haven't been back in 40 years. Shoshone, California is my real home. They call it the gateway to Death Valley. My wife came from London, Arkansas. My daughter went to school in 6 states of the Union, California, Washington, Nevada, North and South Dakota, and Louisiana. Mrs. Stebbins passed away last year, and so I thought I'd see a little of the world." The stars and stripes seemed to break out in the air above his head, and she realized that in America, the leaves were turning. "Where have you been?" she asked.
"You know, it's a funny thing,
But I'm not sure myself. This agency in California planned the trip for me. They told me I'd be traveling with a group of Americans. But as soon as I get on the high seas, I find that I'm traveling alone. I'll never do it again. Sometimes there's whole days in which I don't hear any decent American spoken. Why, sometimes I just sit up in my room and talk to myself for the pleasure of hearing American. Why, I took a bus from Frankfurt to Munich, and you know there wasn't anybody on that bus who spoke a word of English? Then I took a bus from Munich to Innsbruck, and there wasn't anybody on that bus who spoke English either. Then I took a bus from Innsbruck to Venice, and there wasn't anybody on that bus who spoke English either, until some Americans got on at Cortina. But I haven't had any complaints about the hotels, and they usually speak English in the hotels. And I've stayed in some very nice ones. Sitting on a bar stool in a Roman basement, the stranger seemed to Anne to redeem her country. He seemed to gleam with shyness and honesty. The radio was tuned to an armed forces station in Verona, where they were playing a recording of Stardust. Stardust, the stranger said. But I guess you know, it was written by a friend of mine, Hoagie Carmichael. He makes $6,000-$7,000 a year on royalties from that song alone. He's a good friend of mine. I've never met him, but I've corresponded with him. I guess it must seem funny to you that I have a friend I've never met, but Hoagie's a real friend of mine. That statement seemed much more melodic and expressive to Anne than the music. Its juxtaposition, its apparent pointlessness, and the rhythm seemed to her like the music of her own country. And she remembered walking, as a girl, past the piles of sawdust at the spoon factory to the house of her best friend. If she made the walk in the afternoon, she would sometimes have to wait at the grade crossing for a freight to pass. First there would be a sound in the distance like a cave of winds, and then the iron thunder, the clangor of the wheels. The freights went through there at full speed. They stormed through. But reading the lettering on the cars used to move her, used to remind her not of any glamorous promise at the end of the line, but of the breadth and vastness of her own country, as if the states of the Union, wheat states, oil states, coal states, maritime states, were being drawn down the track near where she stood and where she read Southern Pacific, Baltimore and Ohio, Nickel Plate, New York Central, Great Western, Rock Island, Santa Fe, Lackawanna, Pennsylvania, clackety-clacking out of sight. "Don't cry, lady," Mr. Stebbins said. "Don't cry." It was time to go home, and she got a plane for Orly that night and another plane for Idlewild the next evening. She was going home. She was going home. Her heart was in her throat. How dark and fresh the water of the Atlantic looked after all those years away. In the morning light, the low-lying islands with Indian names passed under their starboard wing, and even the houses of Long Island, arranged like the grids of a waffle iron, excited her. They circled the field once and came down. She planned to find a lunch counter in the airport and order a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. She gripped her umbrella, Parisian, and her handbag, Sienese, and waited her turn to leave the plane. But as she was coming down the steps, even before her shoes, Roman, had touched her native earth, she heard a mechanic who was working on a DC-7 at the next gate, singing, "Oh, humid Isabella, never kissed a fella." She never left the airport. She took the next plane back to Orly and joined those hundreds, those thousands of Americans who streamed through Europe, gay or sad, as if they were a truly homeless people. They round a street corner in Innsbruck, 30 strong, and vanish. They swarm over a bridge in Venice and are gone. They can be heard asking for ketchup in a guesthouse above the clouds of the Great Massif, and be seen poking among the sea caves with masks and snorkels and the deep waters off Porta San Stefano. She spent the autumn in Paris. Kitzbühel saw her. She was in Rome for the horse show and in Siena for the palio. She was always on the move, dreaming of bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches.
Nathan Osgood was reading A Woman Without a Country by John Cheever. The producer was Duncan Minchin. Welcome back to Sweden in South Kensington from me, Martin Handley, and to tonight's BBC Prom live here on Radio 3. On stage this evening is the Swedish Chamber Orchestra Örebro, a city in the centre of the country which has been the orchestra's home since its inception 15 years ago. Its chief conductor for all bar the first couple of years of that span has been the Dane Thomas Dausgaard, whose second appearance at this year's proms this is. He's already visited with his other orchestra, of course, the Danish National Symphony. Well, the Swedish Chamber Orchestra ends this concert by coming full circle back to Schumann, whose 200th birthday the Proms has been celebrating with a symphony cycle. Tonight, that's completed with his Beethovenian Second, in which he wrote himself cathartically through his depression. But before that comes the UK premiere of a piece by the Swedish composer Albert Schnelzer, for whom Beethoven was an important influence when he was growing up alongside Pink Floyd. Improvisation's always been a strength of Schnelzer's. He remembers doing it on the piano at preschool, and he then learnt the guitar and he joined a rock band. He was originally going to be an engineer, but chucked that in to study composition, first in Malmö and then at the Royal College of Music, just across from the Royal Albert Hall. The biography in the programme says it was at the RCM he began to develop his natural leaning towards folk music, soft romantics and hard rock. Well, I talked earlier to Albert Schnelzer and conductor Thomas Dausgaard and asked Albert how A Freak in Burbank had come about.
The initial inspiration for this piece was, this was a commission. I was commissioned to write a piece for chamber orchestra with a sort of Haydn twist on it.
This was Esa-Pekka's
idea. Yeah, it was. And so I started with him as sort of an inspiration. But during the time that I composed the piece, I also read a biography about Tim Burton, the film director. And
who you had quite a lot to do with as a youngster, I gather. I mean, you watched a lot of his films.
Yes, of course. So like many in my age, I've seen all his films, and I think they are simply amazing, most of them. And I like them a lot, actually. And what was interesting was that I found similarities instantly. The humour and the burlesque qualities was something that I found very interesting. And what happened was that Tim Burton, when he entered my mind, he more or less took over the piece. So it's, I would say it's 10% Haydn and 90% Tim Burton in the end. But that's the way it went. I had no choice but to let Tim Burton into the piece and let him guide me.
Does Tim Burton know?
Well, I don't know, actually. I haven't had any contact with him so far.
I think we should tell him.
Yeah,
his childhood is wrapped up in a piece by Albert Schnelzer.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's going to be flattered, especially since I called the piece A Freak in Burbank.
Well, that was...
Yeah, but I think his childhood was really interesting because he lived in a very typical American suburb in Burbank. But still, he was probably a really unusual child, and that was kind of, I don't know.
Tormenting his friends and things, isn't he?
Yeah, he
playing tricks on them.
Yeah, and he tore the heads of the toy soldiers, and he did all kind of bizarre things. And I thought that was kind of, both funny and a bit sad at the same time.
Thomas, what appeals to you about Albert's music?
I think there's an immediacy here, and there's a storytelling which I really like. There's a tension, probably most important for me, which carries right through the piece, and it has a very rounded feeling performing it. It has a natural way of flowing along with the inspiring and interesting things all along the way. So there's something, I think, touching us on a very basic level here, and that's done in a very sophisticated way.
You've talked about communication of music, you know, being so important to you. I mean, it's, you know, it's not about writing something that's going to be put on a dusty shelf and forgotten. No. You want your music to speak to people, don't you?
Yeah, I want to speak to people all the time, even when I don't write music. I don't think that should be odd in any way, but I see myself more of a storyteller. I have something that I hear in my mind that I want to tell people, tell them how things sound in my head. That's how I work.
And have you been on tour with the piece and with the orchestra, Thomas? I mean, is this in the middle of a whole...
This is in the middle of the tour, and we play a variety of repertoire, but this is on the tour as well. Yeah. So, yeah, that's...
And how's it being received?
Very well. Always very immediate response. So, yeah, no doubt, it's very positive.
Thomas Dausgaard. And here he is again, coming onto the platform at the Royal Albert Hall, joining the Swedish Chamber Orchestra to give the UK premiere of Albert Schnelzer's A Freak in Burbank.
That was the UK premiere of Albert Schnelzer's A Freak in Burbank, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to begin the second part of tonight's prom by the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. According to Schnelzer, in that piece, he wanted one of his heroes, Haydn, to meet modern America and see if he survived. And Albert Schnelzer comes flying down the steps onto the platform. Big hug for Thomas Dausgaard. You can hear the response for that piece. It was commissioned by the Stockholm Chamber Orchestra, first performed 2008. It's really taken off. 20 performances by 9 different orchestras. Dausgaard's going to do it with the Danish National Symphony Orchestra next month. It's in Canada next year. And Dausgaard and the Swedish Chamber are giving the German premiere at the Philharmonie in Berlin on their German tour soon. Back onto the platform, beaming Albert Schnelzer and Thomas Dausgaard. Impressive list of performances of many of his pieces this year. Musically looks up for James McMillan, Thomas Ades. Says the essence of music for him boils down to singing and dancing. His new oboe concerto, joint commission from tonight's band and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, will be premiered this autumn. And there's a new cello concerto with a world premiere in Gothenburg next year, amongst much else. Great response here in the Royal Albert Hall. And the orchestra all grinning too, they love playing it.
Well, Albert Schnelzer says one of his formative influences when he was growing up was Beethoven, and the Swedish Chamber Orchestra ends its prom with a symphony Beethoven would have both understood and admired, and maybe been rather flattered by. Schumann was certainly taking him as his example when he wrote his second symphony. It wasn't an easy time for him. In the autumn of 1844, he had a complete physical and mental breakdown. The following year, he convalesced in Dresden, complaining the whole time of tinnitus in his ears, studying Bach and composing very little except this symphony. He saw it as depicting his struggle against depression. Schumann told the conductor of an early performance, "It was the resistance of the spirit that was here at work and helped me combat my condition," and added the music reminded him of a dark period. There are none of the outside references to nature or literature as in the title symphonies, the Spring or the Rhenish. The romantic spirit is absorbed into its own very personal world. Schumann saw the first movement as being full of his personal struggle, played out by two themes representing darkness and light, and the way they're used seemed to reflect his inner tension. That struggle spills over into the equally Beethovenian scherzo, as though Schumann's restless spirit was carrying too much unresolved conflict to settle down yet. It's energetic music rather than dramatic, the only relaxation coming in the two trios. The melancholy slow movement's one of the loveliest Schumann ever wrote, delicately scored with romantic horn calls juxtaposed with the plaintive main tune. And the movement ends with the music clothed in glowing orchestral colours. The finale is dominated by the resistance of the spirit theme of the opening, which drives forward to a victory over darkness. The music arriving at a semblance of peace, and a new song-like tune appears related to Beethoven's song cycle, Andi ferne Geliebte, to the distant beloved, surely meant to be Schumann's wife Clara. When it and the resistance of the spirit theme get together, then at last the symphony can end in a blaze of triumphant C major. So here's Thomas Dausgaard once again coming onto the platform at the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the Swedish Chamber Orchestra in Schumann's Second Symphony.
Thank you.
greater splendour as Schumann vanquishes his demons, for the moment anyway, at the end of his second symphony. It's been played here in the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's BBC Prom by the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, Örebro. Leader Katarina Andreasen with its chief conductor Thomas Dausgaard. Good place to end this year's Prom Schumann Symphony Cycle in celebration of the 200th anniversary of his birth. Wildness, risk-taking. Thomas Dausgaard says you need to do that. And he certainly was conducting the music, not the bars, bringing the wind to their feet. Swedish Chamber Orchestra, not a period instrument band, but playing with valveless trumpets and, as you heard, tightly strung timps, hard sticks, and very discreet vibrato. Swedish Chamber Orchestra on its feet now. Dausgaard says balance difficulties with symphony orchestras instantly resolved when playing Schumann with the Chamber Orchestra, and that this orchestra is about the same size as the Municipal Orchestra in Dusseldorf, of which Schumann was music director. It's not the only way, he says, but it brings greater clarity and flexibility. Certainly you heard that flexibility there. The great joy they all have in music making. I asked Dausgaard what the secret is to being a long-lived music director, as it were, 13 years. Well, they're applauding him hugely. Obviously a very warm relationship between orchestra and conductor, as Thomas Dausgaard brings the Swedish Chamber Orchestra to its feet. There are three concerts in Stockholm 2 days ago, a day of royal celebrations, ending with a concert performing Beatles numbers with a rock band. Thomas Dausgaard was a member of one when he was young. And tomorrow they're in Oslo, and their debut at the Salzburg Festival on Saturday. As for Thomas Dausgaard himself, he makes his debut with the Cleveland Orchestra this coming season, goes back to Toronto, to Cincinnati, to the Vienna Symphony. Here he is back on the platform. I think it's some more. Sibelius and Dante Festivo, played as an encore by the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. Well, tomorrow here at the Proms, the orchestra comes from about as far away from central Sweden as it's possible to get. The Sydney Symphony Orchestra is in town for its first visit in 15 years, with its music director, Vladimir Ashkenazi, a far more regular visitor, of course. The suite from Richard Strauss's opera, Der Rosenkavalier, Ravel's G major piano concerto, with Hélène Grimaud, the soloist, sways to the blues. And continuing this year's Proms performances of Scriabin, his third symphony, The Divine Poem, seeks to join the human spirit and the universe in a cosmic dance. Thomas Dausgaard and his orchestra all on their feet, taking the applause of the audience. Well, that's at 7:30 tomorrow, live here on Radio 3, of course. But for now, time for me to hand you on to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, many thanks. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. Just remind you that if you want to hear that Prom again, you can do so on the afternoon of Bank Holiday Monday, a week today from 2 here on Radio 3. Tomorrow afternoon's Prom repeat is another chance to hear the Prom from last Tuesday. It featured the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Edward Gardner, beginning with that beautiful meditation on the life of Benjamin Britten by Arvo Pärt, with that bell tolling at the start and most powerfully at the end, the Cantus in Memoriam, Benjamin Britten. Britten's own music also features in the 4C interludes from Peter Grimes. Last Tuesday also heard a brand new violin concerto, a BBC commission from Hugh Watkins, and the afternoon will draw to a conclusion with a performance of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. That's all from 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. And earlier in the day...
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties, in Breakfast on Radio 3, every morning from 7.
And that was Sarah Moore-Peach. Well, what of the rest of the evening tonight on Radio 3? Next is our next in the series of Monday evening in-depth conversations with notable musicians. Continuing at 9:45, Norman Lebrecht will be talking to the American-born pianist Stephen Kovacevich, who's celebrating his 70th birthday this year. He made his Wigmore Hall debut back in 1961, and he'll be reflecting on life in the fast lane of the music business as it developed in the intervening years in this week's Lebrecht interview. That's all after A Short Jig by William Byrd. Canadian Brass playing the music of William Byrd, bringing the time now to 9:45. We have music by Mendelssohn, 10:30, a performance by members of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme, the Elias Quartet. And at 11, David Crystal ponders what Samuel Johnson would have made of the internet. It's the first of our week of late-night essays considering Johnson now. And the first one, Johnson, the Dictionary, the Wiki and the Web, is at 11 this evening. And if you're a jazz fan, then do join Jez Nelson after that for a concert by the pianist Django Bates and his trio Beloved Bird. They're playing interpretations of the music of Charlie Parker in Jazz on 3 at 11:15 this evening. Programmes for the rest of the night here on BBC Radio 3. And before all of that, it's time for this week's Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Stephen Bishop Kovacevic is a pianist for whom the adjective classical might have been invented. He confines himself to old masters, Beethoven and Brahms, Mozart and Schubert, and he plays with deep penetration and a lofty disdain for changes of style and fashion. He's old school and proud of it. When the music industry was at its busiest, he, together with Vladimir Ashkenazy and Alfred Brendel, covered the core repertoire. An American of Croatian heritage, he came to London in 1959 to study with Dame Myra Hess and never really left. He's changed his name twice and shared intense relationships with Jacqueline Dupré and Martha Argerich, yet he's always stood apart from the star circuit, occupying a space entirely his own. On October 17, when he turns 70, he'll be joined by musicians young and old for a momentous birthday celebration at the Wigmore Hall. Stephen Kovacevic, did you ever think of yourself as a leader of the field? Did you look in the mirror and think, I've made it?
I think I've said to myself, I've made it. Leader, there isn't a leader in anything. I don't actually think in those terms. Obviously, I prefer some people in a certain repertoire, me included, or not. But leader is it's a dead burden.
But you've talked to the field as being highly competitive.
Well, there are a lot of good people, mm-hmm. and people who have something to offer.
And that sense of satisfaction of having sort of joined the leaders, being on the leaderboard.
Well, I know I've achieved something, yes. I won't paint myself into a corner more than that.
Just tell me then, when you felt you'd achieved that, what did it take for you to achieve that?
I would say facetiously, I'm still looking forward to it, but I suppose it was hearing some recordings I made, which made me actually think, hey, wait, this really is something. Brahms 2 with Colin Davis, Bartok 2 with Colin Davis. And so it's an accumulation of hearing some of the good things you've done, realizing that more often than not, that is what happens. And then inevitably you hear other people in your repertoire and you sometimes think, well, I wish I could do that. Or you think, I'm glad I couldn't do that. So it alternates. But I think, by and large, you do have an idea where you are. But anybody who is really personal is unique. And I think that's what you really try to bring out.
You've described yourself somewhere as a gloomy sod, with something of Dostoevsky in your soul.
Well, I wish as intelligent as he is, but yeah, gloomy is quite often the case, yes.
And where does that come from?
Have no idea. You could say Croatian blood, Slavic blood, I don't know. It's quite strong, although I enjoy my life. But underneath it all is a festering malcontent.
Isn't that essential for an artist?
Well, if it is, I've got it, but I don't know if it's I don't know if it's essential.
Let's go back to beginnings. Your father jumped ship in Los Angeles in 1939.
Something like that, yeah.
Was he running away from Europe, away from war, or was he...
I think he was running away from Europe. He arrived, his brothers were already there. He didn't speak any English. And he had been trained as an engineer, but they all made a fortune. They all lost it. But they made a fortune in fishing. He was one of the first people to do frozen fish. But he had some notoriously bad business dealings in South America, and it all went up the spout. But for a time, he was wealthy and successful.
But you grew up fairly comfortable because he was doing quite well from quite early
on? Yes. When I was no more than 5, we had a very good sound system, and I fell in love with music through hearing Mozart 40. Well, if you speak of gloom, I remember thinking, there must be something I don't know about life that anybody should write music like this. that is obviously a deep response to music and not a particularly happy character, even at 4.5 or 5. That's why the opening of Mozart 40 is sacred to me. You don't mess with it. And there's a darkness. A good friend of mine described it as a homage to inner anguish, and it's true. But I picked that up when I was 5. I also loved Wagner. I thought Wagner was great. And
Ride of the Valkyries, was it?
No, Meistersinger. Mm. Still to this day, I loved the Toscanini performance of the Prelude. And Johann Strauss. Those are the 3 people I loved.
Were you already playing at 5?
No, or? I played badly when I was around 7, less badly when I was 8, and, well, when I was 11.
You were already taking lessons then with...
Lev Shor, a Russian. And I stayed with him until I was 18 and came here to Myra Hess.
How did you find Lev Shor?
He was very, very good in terms of accuracy, rhythmic verve, and characterization. I mean, he was a good musician. But when I came to Myra Hess, I think my playing was rather limited in variation in sound, I think. And she opened up a whole world because whatever you say about her, I mean, I do think she was a deep and great artist, but her sound had a huge range. And that was a revelation, and it inspired me.
Your parents weren't together for very long?
No.
How old were you when...
I don't know, 2 or 3, something like that.
And then your mother remarried a man called Bishop.
That's why I got struck with this name, Bishop.
And did you see much of your father when you were growing up?
He was very much persona non grata, because the marriage was a bad breakup. So not until I was adolescent did I see him, but only then, once or twice a year. And furtively and guiltily, because it was of a generation when people didn't know how to divorce. I think they're better at it now.
But they were Catholics. It can't have been easy at any time.
No, but I mean the thing of the children not being allowed to like the bad boy.
So you started out as Stephen Bishop.
I started off as Kovacevic.
But you made your name as Stephen Bishop.
Yes.
And then against all music industry advice, you changed to Bishop Kovacevic. And then finally you changed to Kovacevic.
Yes.
And was that a kind of atonement for your father? Was it
Well, he had always wanted me to use the name Kovacevic, but for family reasons at the time, and also I suppose I didn't have the guts, but I also think the family dynamics were such that my mother would have been too upset. So it wasn't going to happen.
Was it also a way of expressing the Croat in you?
Yes.
It was reaching for that particular heritage?
The tradition of great Slavic performers was something I was hoping to be part of.
Your mother, you've described as rather pushy, someone who wanted you to succeed, but at the same time, because she needed you around, she also wanted your career, you said, to be a disaster.
That's an amalgamation of quotes. It's not quite right. She wasn't pushy. No, I'll give her that. She wasn't pushy. I had for example, when I was adolescent, I had sport, and I had a fairly normal time. In the state schools at that time were very cooperative. I was home practicing at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. About the career, I think when she realized that I was going to have a life of my own and she wouldn't be part of it, then I think that it's possible that some bitterness crept in. And if I had disasters, and of course I did from time to time, I wouldn't say if she opened up champagne, but it probably assuaged some bitterness, yes.
And was there the sort of response from her that this is because you left me and went halfway across the world?
Well, that kind of thing, I think, yes. It's rather curious that that was so strong in her, but I think it was.
Very hard for you to live with. Well, conflicting messages.
You're prone to guilt about everything that way, because one of the ways to anger the Furies is to do one of the unpardonable things, that is, not to love one or both of your parents. And so there I was, and that surely had consequences. And I also believed in the Catholic faith at the time. Now there aren't words for how I would treat the catechism, but then that also induces guilt, because you're made to feel that your essence is, you know, flawed and the whole thing. So it was a tough but by no means unusual background.
Stephen, would you say it was as much formative as it was inhibiting, that you were getting these conflicting messages of which parent to follow, or that one parent was excluded?
No, I think that was... My father became an uncle figure more than anything else. No, I think the conflicting messages is not a conflicting message, but it's a... If you see one parent, my mother, so unhappy, it's actually unbearable. And so you try to construct a... Well, you think, why should it happen? Why should life be so unfair on this person? She had very bad health. And I think part of my original drive, the passion for late Beethoven, is that one of the subtexts is that there is consolation, there is radiance, there is ultimately some benign destiny. Now, I don't have that anymore at all, but I still love late Beethoven as much. I can't explain why I do. I've lost the comfort, the promise that it implied, but I still love the music as much as I ever did. It's the music and the late quintets of Mozart and mazurkas of Chopin that I love most of all.
When you carry on playing it now without the comfort,
yeah,
how does that feel?
I'm still as taken by it as I ever was. But when I play Opus 110, which I've recently started playing again, I find the piece more and more mysterious, which is a wonderful thing to find. And the Diabelli, I played a lot when I was young, and then I stopped for 25 or 30 years. And as you'll probably know, I recently brought it back. And the end of the Diabelli is rather similar to something in Mozart. I don't know what exactly in Mozart, but this feeling of transcendence and grace, grace and transcendence takes over. The last minuet is absolutely amazing music. And there's nothing that I can think of that is quite so Mozartian in spirit in Beethoven as that. Again, Beethoven, whether he had comfort or not with his own muse, I don't know, because if I believe one of the last things, he had a tough life. People don't realize how much physical pain this man had. And although I was pleased to read that as a young man, he had quite a romantic life, and people were quite jealous how this ugly guy could have so much fun. But that certainly faded, and he was lonely and single, and with a great deal of physical pain. And one of the last things he said, apparently, is, oh, the comedy is over now. This is deathbed stuff. Hmm. And what he meant by that, we don't know, whether he... But it's certainly not a... It's not a radiant thing to say.
Yeah. Lev Shor, your teacher.
Yeah.
Russian tradition.
Russian tradition.
Chopin, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff.
Yes, yes, yes.
You've never played Rachmaninoff in public.
I love it.
But you never played it?
I've never played it. I learned the third, and then I couldn't face the night before the first rehearsal, and I knew I couldn't.
So you were actually going to play the D minor and...
6 months before, I knew that. Because the most difficult piece I'd learned until then, and it is as hard in its way, is Bartok II. And that took me 9 months of slavery. I paralyzed my right hand during the time. I had to have therapy to unlock it. And... Okay, the first performances were okay, not very good. But I eventually really, really did learn to play this piece. And I think that the ferocity and the anger in Bartok II probably suited me when I was a young man. A Rachmaninoff third is a great piece, but I'm not sure it appeals to the inner demon as much as Bartok II. I think they're all wonderful. He's the greatest pianist, in my opinion, of them all. A view not only shared by me. I'm interested now in number 4, which is the so-called Ugly Duckling, but I think that the small interlude in the last movement is as beautiful as anything he or anybody ever wrote. It's a curious piece, very economic.
One that sounds a little bit like Three Blind Mice.
The middle movement is a Three Blind Mice. Mm. As a composer, parenthetically, it's curious because he said, why? Because Three Blind Mice is also the Schumann Concerto in a way. He said, why didn't anybody tell me? But the fact that a composer would say, why didn't anybody tell me, is completely nuts. It comes from a prelude, and that when the prelude was written, it had its own beauty, and it never occurred to him that it was influenced by any other music.
So from a very early age, you're aware that there are composers and pianists that you admire.
Love, not admire.
Love.
Love.
But that you wouldn't emulate and their works you wouldn't play.
Yes. Also, the music that I choose to listen to isn't necessarily the music that I play. The only exception where it all fits is, and I do them well, but I don't do them in public very often, though this may change, the mazurkas. Now, the rubato implied in a mazurka is something that, first of all, I think it's in your blood, except for Futsong, who really, really is not noticeably Slavic, but he does have this rubato in his blood somewhere.
So and you just have to come from the far end of Danube if you're going to play
I'm
that.
I'm probably talking nonsense. But the waltzes can be done, let's say, for me, not so well, and I don't really mind. But if a mazurka is done with pseudo-rubato and fake rubato, it actually enrages me. I can't bear it, because this is some of the greatest music ever written. And I know quite a few of the mazurkas. But to show you how difficult this rhythm is, or this rubato, let's say I didn't have to practice and there was a piano here. I could play the notes. It would take me weeks to get the rubato back.
I mean, it's fascinating to me that you should have formed these aesthetic compartments so early in your life that you knew what you were going to play and the particular style that you wanted for it, and that this has just developed, obviously, and matured.
Yes.
But the self-knowledge...
Knowledge is too cold a word. I would think just intuition. For better or for worse, that's where I am.
And then Myra Hess came to town.
Great.
And you heard a different way of playing. We tend to think of her in England as a national monument, a kind of...
That was the death of her.
Yeah. We still think of her as a kind of Boadicea who carried on playing Beethoven at the National Gallery while Nazi bombs were exploding all around her.
It was so, in purely crude show business terms, she was overexposed. You took her for granted. And this did have a consequence, because she played more wildly in America than she ever did here. I heard her in America. You wouldn't recognize it. And blasphemy of blasphemy, she actually preferred, though she wouldn't admit it, the American Steinway, because it was raucous and it was, you know, it had a wild quality. And she responded. She could fill Carnegie Hall. There aren't many people who can do that. And she played differently. When she played here, it was like, you know, auntie giving tea. And it's destructive because it inhibits you if you think the public views you in a certain way. And there was a generation of bright young things coming down from Cambridge and Oxford writing reviews about her, which were completely making their own name and dismissive of what was great with her. They had their own ambitious ends. That's their business. But it hurt.
Did she discuss herself with you? Or she was very much the teacher. She was very much leading you into paths.
To my surprise, she was Christian in some sense, though being Jewish. I don't know what that meant to her, but it meant something.
What do you mean by being Christian?
Well, I mean, she would say the Lord and things like that, which implied that it meant something to her. I don't know what it meant to her, but it surprised me.
And you got a scholarship to come over and study.
Yes, from the University of California. I was just treating them as a conservatory, just using their practice pianos. And they knew I had to get out of Berkeley in order to do anything. And they, through something called the Hertz Award, but they administered it, they gave me 2 years carte blanche to come here. And, of course, it was the making of me.
What was the revelation for you from Myra Hess?
We both loved late Beethoven. I didn't like Beethoven when I was an adolescent, but I heard Serkin's recording of the Diabelli and fell in love with that. She, of course, had heard the Diabelli but didn't know it. And we, as it were, discovered it together because I wanted to learn it and play it. And it was a study of 6 or 9 months, something. And she adored this music. And so the revelation was the joy and the mystery and the wonder that is there. I mean, the other sonatas she knew. Her hands weren't big enough to play the Hammerklavier, but she loved this music, and she would have done it magnificently. She just couldn't stretch it.
So were you in some sense a surrogate, that you were pushing out her way of playing into a new generation? You were continuing the
tradition?
Well,
I think, I don't know surrogate, but I think I was influenced strongly, and I appreciate it and acknowledge it in the last 10 years, maybe more than I did earlier.
The other dominant figure in late Beethoven, if we're talking about late Beethoven, is, of course, Arthur Schnabel. How did that affect you? How did the whole Schnabel work?
Well, when I was an adolescent and heard his recordings, I was struck, but I was also amazed by the inaccuracies of it, you know, in a rather prim fashion. But
the freedom to play wrong notes.
Well, he was very free. But now I'd rather hear him play the Hammerklavier with the millions of wrong notes than most people with all the right notes. I'm exaggerating slightly, but not much. And certainly the sarcasm implied in what I'm saying has truth in it, because we tend to type things these days. And you couldn't call him a typist.
I don't think we could call you a typist.
No, I hope not.
Did Myra Hess open doors to you, to the music establishment?
Well, her agent, Emmy Tillett, the doyen of...
Mrs. Tillett.
Mrs. Tillett. Of course, she took me on, and that was a huge thing.
And Mrs. Tillett arranged your debut?
That's...
1961?
Yes. It cost £60 in those days to hire and give a concert at the Wigmore Hall.
What do you remember of it?
I remember arriving Sunday afternoon, it was snowing, and the program was Berg Sonata, Three Preludes and Fugues of Bach and the Diabelli. I began the Berg Sonata, and like it or not, or whether you understand the music or not, the first eight bars of the Berg Sonata can be sight-read. You know, it's not really difficult. I looked out at my hands, and they were shaking, and I thought, my God, in 45 minutes, I have to play the Diabelli. This isn't going to happen. Well, it did. That's what I remember, because I had no experience of giving concerts, almost none.
So nerves.
Frightful, yes.
And that pursued you?
Yeah, they're much better recently, in the last couple, 5 or 6 years, maybe slightly more. But
what did you do about it?
I've tried all the usual things.
Beta blockers?
I mean, I haven't taken a beta blocker in 25 years, but I took them for a short time. And, you know, you're so slow and you're so bored. I believe they're more sophisticated now. But in any case, it didn't help. What did actually help was, well, I don't know what age gives you, but it's not completely negative. And very close to being completely negative, but not totally. And one of the things is you become tougher. And I mean, I had some health problems in the last few years, and I played some stinking concerts during that time. But that was absolutely health orientated. But you get tougher. Still, it's not a picnic walking on stage, but you do get tougher.
When you go on stage, do you feel as if you have a right to be there?
Yes.
You've earned it.
I don't know if I've earned it, but I have a right to be there.
Okay. So why would you feel nervous if you have a right?
Well, because there's always things that can go wrong. I mean, Horowitz had more technique than most people would ever dream about, and he made colossal mistakes. That can happen. And if that does happen, it's terrifying. I'm not talking about a slip of a note or something. But I can understand why, for example, in his first recording of the Third Rachmaninoff, there's a little cadenza, which actually isn't hard to play. But Rachmaninoff writes veloce. Now, to someone like Horowitz or to someone like me, that's just the worst thing, because you know you're going to get overexcited. You're going to go too fast. And Horowitz, during Rachmaninoff's lifetime, completely rewrote that little cadenza, not because he couldn't play in his sleep. And there's also this thing of temptation of, if you're not tempted into something dangerous, how are you able to achieve something exciting? I don't think it's a free pass. There are people today who can play octaves as fast as Horowitz. It doesn't mean that they give you goose pimples. And I once played for Horowitz. It was an absolutely fantastic evening. I arrived at 9. I left at 2 in the morning. And he was polite and gracious and wonderful. Now, he started to play something, and I was at the other end of the piano. There was an octave passage coming up, and I wanted to look at his hands, but I decided not to, because I thought it was cheap. I wouldn't learn anything. In those days, I was a little clairvoyant. And he stopped playing, and he said, "You're right." He said, "People come here," and this is all to do with typing or not. He said, "People come here and think they can steal octaves. You have to have a Mephistophelian spirit to play octaves." And that's why today people can play quickly, but they don't play with that furore that makes them exciting. You hear, not necessarily the recording, but one of the Toscanini Tchaikovsky things that are available. And the last passage is actually frightening. And it's not necessarily faster, although it is excruciatingly fast. But this spirit. And so you walk on stage, and in your own way, you delve into that. And that is not a free pass. You don't type that. And there are passages in Beethoven. I'm sorry, Beethoven is not a safe composer. There are passages which are meant to be, they are dangerous. They're meant to be dangerous. They should be dangerous for the performer, and the audience should feel part of this, whatever it is. And that doesn't come from conservatory preparation. That comes from an inner compulsion, an intuition.
So this is the beginning. You make your debut.
Yeah.
You get married about the same time. You're 20 years old.
Yeah.
Your wife is a Catholic and
yes.
a psychoanalyst. You have two sons. This is all happening, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. Much too soon, but yeah. nevertheless, yeah. And, worthwhile.
And,
yes.
And it's London. It's the 1960s, and yeah. things are starting to swing.
Yeah.
How are you affected by all of that?
After a while, I partook of the London freedom. Not for 5 or 6 years after that. And that was a good period for everybody.
Through Mrs. Tillett, you met this exuberant young cellist, Jacqueline Dupré.
Yes, that is the person I've most enjoyed working with in my life.
Almost immediately, you were giving recitals around the country.
Pretty soon. And she is the most gifted musical person I've encountered.
What was the most appealing thing?
Well, she had a kind of genius. You know, the film that Christopher Nupin made where she plays the piano. She couldn't play the piano. I tell you, you hear Jackie even when she's playing the piano. You hear something, and I don't know how it works. I really don't know how it works. Maybe some love of music. She had a wonderful attitude towards performing. She was atheist, but she used some religious terms. She said, I've been given a God-given talent, and it's my privilege to share it with my friends. Well, there's not a better attitude in life than that.
You were so different, though. She was so impetuous, you were so serious.
Well, it worked. And we recorded two Beethoven sonatas, the A major, which is good, but on the goody-goody side, and the D major, which really is wonderful.
Incredible.
Yeah, that
yes.
is incredible.
Yes.
There's no other way to describe it. It is incredible.
It's quite miraculous.
Yeah.
Part of the miracle are these two contrasting temperaments, you and her,
yes,
coming
but
together.
She's the only one who I've ever persuaded, but I didn't need persuade, to play the last movement really quickly. Everybody's so scholar, because it's very difficult with the piano. Actually, it isn't any easier if you play slowly. You're just, you know, it doesn't really help. And the slow movement, the first movement I don't think is especially problematic, and ours is good, but there are plenty of others that are good too. But the second and third movements, there's a depth to the slow movement. And I remember recording this at Abbey Road. We didn't even look at each other during these slow passages when you have to play chords together. Didn't even look. There was a complete rapport. And the last movement really takes off. And I wish people would play it like that, because instead of a sort of poor man's fugetta.
When she fell ill in the 70s
yeah.
with multiple sclerosis and she went into rapid decline, you were one of her most treasured visitors.
The last 4 years of her life, I saw her once a month. That wasn't at the onset of her illness. But it's true, the last 4 years, I was there once a month. Well, not only me, there were other people who you went in, you saw, you looked ahead in her diary. When there was a free night, you made sure that somebody was there. And if you were free, you put yourself down.
It was organized.
Yeah.
And you shared what you'd had, or you...
I don't know how she did it. Mm. I don't know how she did it, but there would be half a minute in which the old magic was still there. I don't know how it happened. She hated being ill, and all the people who were close to her, they couldn't... Really, you couldn't get over it. Probably for the first year or so when I started to visit her, I thought about it all the time. I tried to make sense of it, which, of course, is just nonsense.